This time on Weather Brains. Is Alabama's early cool spell an indication of things to come? James Spann weighs in.
You can't call winter based on an early season cold snap.
J.B. Elliott's four-legged friend can handle the chill.
Miss Molly loves cold weather. It has to get down below freezing before we put her little sweater on.
Also this time, an alabaster couple was visiting Hawaii during the October 15th earthquake. How does it feel to be in the middle of a 6.7 earthquake that you never even noticed?
Well, it was pretty exciting, actually.
Plus, a Weather Brains extra, reaching for the stars.
Start, 2, 1, boost your ignition. And liftoff of the space shuttle.
Scientists right here in Alabama working on the rockets that will take Americans back to the moon and Mars. We'll talk with Steve Cook, the NASA scientist overseeing development of those rockets, about what's planned, as well as concerns about the dwindling number of young people making science a career.
The great nations have always been those that have maintained their technological capability. If we lose that capability, if we lose that edge, it really is kind of scary for the long term, what it means for this country in the long term.
Plus, getting ready for a valuable severe weather learning experience.
This is where we teach people how to look for small-scale features of storms that can lead to tornadoes or that can be very important.
It's Storm Alert Extreme.
If you listen to Weather Brains, you'll love Storm Alert Extreme.
That and more coming up. Welcome to episode 39 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about the weather, produced by the Weather Geeks from the Weather Company in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm one of those geeks, David Black, along with James Spann, lead meteorologist from ABC 3340 Birmingham, also with us, Brian Peters and J.B. Elliott. Hey, James, how you doing?
David, I love October. What a great time of the year. I'm having a great time enjoying the cool weather.
Stupendous. Brian, you on board? You staying out of trouble? No arrests, no brushes with the law, no embarrassing incidents, anything like that, right?
No arrests and no outstanding warrants. And I must admit, I love October also, but I have to admit that this has got to be one of the most unusual Octobers that we've had in recent Octobers with all the rain. October's supposed to be dry.
I know. But I'm not complaining. It's been nice to have. Somebody else nice to have is J.B. Elliott. Mr. Elliott, how are you, sir?
I'm also an October guy, but I love the rain, too. I'm a rainmonger. We need the rain.
We needed it, and it's done good things for our yards and our mental attitudes, too, probably. So, tell you what, we're recording this on a Monday, and we have sure had another taste of fall in Alabama. Speaking of nice falls, how about a real quick look at the coming week, Mr. Spann? What do you say we're in for? What does it look like?
Well, I guess the screaming message is that warm weather is just not going to happen anytime soon. The normal high down here in Birmingham for this time of the year would be in the low 70s. Today, many folks had a hard time hitting 50. Our Mount Sheehaw Skycam network location had a high of 49, and Gadsden today hit 51. So we're running about 15 to 20 degrees below normal. And, we got a big rain event on Thursday, and then another surge of cool air by the weekend. So, cool is the word, and I think that's what strikes me is the amount of cold air that is over North America. And it just has to make you wonder about the winter season ahead. Not that that means it'll be a cold winter, but boy, it's getting off to a cold start. And tonight, we're expecting a freeze for many spots. The average date of the first freeze here is the 8th of November. So for that to be happening, on the 24th of October, that's a little early. So this makes you go,
Well, but, some folks would look at that, like you're saying, and assume that maybe this means we are in for a really brutal, harsh winter. But you're saying this may not be the case. It could warm up again later on.
Look, you can't call winter based on an early season cold snap, but I do find it interesting that it's this cold this early in the season. And, we've had tremendous records already set, like the Buffalo snowstorm. That was historic, and that was over a week ago. So it just makes you wonder. And our luck's going to run out. We will have a brutally cold winter one year. And whether it's this one or not, I don't know. Nobody knows. But we'll just sit back and wait and watch.
Well, let's hope there's no ice to go with it.
Yeah, and to play devil's advocate, I remember some Decembers when we were hitting almost 70 degrees. Remember those, you guys?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Anything's possible, right?
I remember seeing J.B. in his Bermuda shorts at Christmas one year.
J.B. Elliott in his Bermuda shorts. That's an interesting visual.
Yeah, up until it gets down to 32.
And then you're not in your shorts anymore?
No.
That's his cutoff. You know, he has these Bermuda shorts and black socks and dress shoes.
Yes, I look like I'm from England or someplace.
Well, I got a question when we have these chilly fall mornings, which, by the way, have just been outstanding. Yours truly has managed to get up before dawn, take the 4.9-pound killer attack poodle for a walk through the neighborhood. Fispo loves it. JB, I'm curious, what kind of wrapping and packaging do you do for Miss Molly when you take her out on these chilly autumn mornings?
Miss Molly loves cold weather. It has to get down below freezing before we put her little sweater on, even down into the 20s. That's about the time I put on another shirt besides a short sleeve shirt.
And, you know, to give equal time here, Brian, you've got a four-legged family member.
I was just thinking Dakota was really enjoying it. She's, of course, Shelties have a very thick coat, so she doesn't care for the hot weather. And today she spent most of the day outside. It was such a beautiful day, and I can't blame her.
So, James, I think if you really want to be viewer sensitive there, you need to have a canine weather forecast, you know, for what kind of dress the canines are going to need in the fall. Just one little extra piece of responsibility to deal with.
I feel left out here. We used to have an old mutt, but my wife kind of developed an allergy to dogs. And so we've kind of had to, we've been without a dog for, I guess, 15 years now. So I'll just enjoy the Miss Molly stories.
Everybody does. How about being right in the middle of an area hit by a magnitude 6.7 earthquake? And how about this? You don't even notice it. You believe that? Alabaster resident Michelle Tatum and her husband Brandon traveled to Hawaii for a week-long stay. They arrived the night before the earthquake. We all heard about it on the news just a week or so back. But when the tremor hit, Michelle says they never felt a thing. Tell me where you were. What was it like?
Oahu. We didn't actually feel the earthquake because we were driving over to Pearl Harbor. And so, you know, I don't guess you can feel it when you're driving in a car. But once we got there, we were talking to several of the people and found out that the power was out. And they had felt it because they were there in line. And
so you didn't know it was happening while you were driving?
No, not till we got to Pearl Harbor and then, you know, talked to some of the people and the rangers came out and were explaining to everyone that the power was out and that we had experienced an earthquake. And, you know, unfortunately we weren't out there. Had we have gotten up on time and had been out there, we would have felt it. But
so you didn't feel a thing?
No. We were in a Jeep and my husband was, you know, driving and we didn't. I don't guess you can feel it when you're driving, so.
Now, I understand there was more than one, that there was a pretty good aftershock.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't notice that either?
No, honestly, we didn't.
Did you see a lot of damage?
Not on the island that we were on. There was kind of like during a bad storm, you know, there were a couple trees and stuff that knocked down the power lines and that kind of thing, but nothing structurally that we could really see, little rock slides here and there.
It sounds like it didn't really affect your trip that much.
No, it didn't. The first, that day, everything was out. Traffic lights, hotel, you know, everything. There was nowhere to eat, nowhere to go shopping, nothing. I mean, but, you know, we don't go to Hawaii for that. So we just drove around the island, even though they advised us not to, because it was a bit dangerous, to be honest with you, to drive, because no one was really obeying the stop at the light kind of deal.
Sounds like it was kind of chaotic Sunday afternoon.
Oh, well, you know, yeah, it was. It was all day because the power didn't come back on. You know, it went off at 7, I guess, that morning with the earthquake, and then it didn't come back on until at least 9:30 that night. So, I mean, it was all day, you know, without anything. So We had an adventure in finding someone who's using a generator to roast whole chickens, and he was selling them up on the North Shore. So that's what we had for lunch, and for dinner we had granola bars that we had packed. So,
so how does it feel to be in the middle of a 6.7 earthquake that you never even noticed?
Well, it was pretty exciting, actually. My husband got a T-shirt that actually came out the next day that said, "I survived the quakes," and it's got the Hawaiian hula, is what they called it. And it had the times and the size, I guess, of the earthquake. So,
Maybe you were in the right place at the right time not to feel it.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. I mean, it was exciting anyway. You know, we got phone calls from moms and grandmothers and everybody concerned because it hit the news, you know, about an hour after it happened, and they were all, you know, very, very concerned.
Michelle and Brandon Tatum can say they survived the earthquake. They just can't tell you exactly what it was like. Any of you guys ever been through an earthquake?
Not of any magnitude.
I have been through tornadoes and hurricanes and floods and heat waves and droughts and hailstorms. But in terms of a big earthquake, I've never been in one. I do remember feeling one. I guess this was about 3 years ago. We had one centered up in northeast Alabama, and I heard the pipes rattling about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't know what that was. But it turned out to be a small earthquake. Never a big one, though, like that.
I felt one when I was a college student in California back in the dark ages. And, of course, earthquakes out there are not exactly an unusual event. But the seismic experts say we could be in for a big one in this part of the country someday, too. I hope not, but it could happen. But anyway, the Tatums had their trip there complete with roast chicken there and granola bars. Sounds interesting. James wanted to bring something up about the ABC 3340 weather blog for folks who are just listening to us perhaps for the first time. That's a pretty popular website, abc3340.com. Check out the weather blog. You're getting a lot of folks now in this time of year sending in some gorgeous fall pictures from all sorts of places.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, even while the show's been going on here, I had another one, some beautiful views taken by one of our readers right down the Tennessee River. He was traveling from Decatur to Huntsville, and he crossed on the old U.S. 31 bridge, and the colors are really starting to come out. So, and again, that's one of the big changes we've had in recent years. It seems like everybody's got a digital camera or phone camera, and they can just send it to us. So it's kind of neat. We can see the fall colors even if you can't get out and see it yourself. So we'll try and post some more of those on the blog. But if anybody wants to look, it's Alabama WEX. .com, Alabama WX, and I'll try and post some more of these over the next couple of days. And even in my backyard, David, I went out there and took some shots Saturday. It's starting to look awfully nice. Sometimes you forget to look in your backyard, but we got some really good colors back there.
Well, and I noticed, too, that you're just getting more and more participation, too, from folks reporting morning low temperatures. The sky watchers are really active. You're really seeing, it seems to me anyway, you're really seeing quite an increase in online web activity with viewers of the station.
Oh, yeah, interactivity. We absolutely love that. And the Sky Watcher program just keeps growing. And I got to do a couple of shameless plugs here, David. Speaking of the Sky Watchers, our annual training event is coming up November the 11th, and I'll let Mr. Peters address that since he's kind of the grand poopah of that. We call it Storm Alert Extreme, and this is where we teach people how to look for small-scale features of storms that can lead to tornadoes or that can be very important. So, Brian, plug away.
Jeez, it sounds like you said it all right there. Well, we're going to try to talk about some of the characteristics you can look for. I think a lot of people want to come to spotter training and be told that you look for A, B, and C, and when you see those, you're going to get a tornado. Unfortunately, the nature doesn't work that way, but there are a lot of visual clues out there. I'm going to try to give some examples through slides and a little bit of video and show people what they can look for, and hopefully get more eyes and ears out there and ways to report back. And James is going to be talking about the Sky Watcher Network as well and how to get everything set up. So it looks like a great day, and we're going to be at the BJCC at the auto show, so that's going to be exciting, too.
David, we're kind of doing this in conjunction with the Alabama International Auto Show. They invited us to be involved, and it's kind of cool. We'll have a special entrance for the folks going to the Storm Alert Extreme. We'll post that on the website, but when you get out of the Extreme show, and again, this is Saturday the 11th of November, you can go check out the car show, which is pretty cool.
Is this the deal where you guys are going to pick a name and Brian is going to buy a new car on the floor for some lucky viewer? Is that the thing?
Well, for everybody that shows up, you know, if we get 500 people, then 500 new cars. So that's we thought that's a really good incentive to get a big crowd down there.
Hey, JB, you want to go? Might be a new ride in it for us.
Sounds interesting.
Okay.
But I will say this, David. We started this a few years ago, and Brian came on board, and he won't say this, but I will. He's one of the best Skywarn trainers in the country, and for him to be able to teach is just a rare opportunity. So bring the whole family. The details are up on the website, but it's Saturday the 11th, and we'll start about 9 o'clock, and we'll wrap up at 3:30. We'll have lunch available down there at the BJCC. But again, it's downtown Birmingham, at the Birmingham Jefferson Civic Center at the Exhibition Hall, and all the details are up on the website. So we, and anybody that listens to this, if you listen to Weather Brains, you'll love Storm Alert Extreme. So come on down.
Sounds like an exciting event. We were talking a couple of minutes ago about the crisp autumn weather and out walking our four-legged critters, and probably all of us from time to time have been out at night, hopefully away from city lights, looked up at the stars and pondered one's existence. I sure enjoy doing that. Imagine traveling to the moon and staying for weeks or months at a time. Or imagine sending a manned expedition to Mars. I don't know about you guys, but that continues to sound like science fiction for a lot of folks. But scientists right here in Alabama, get this, are already hard at work developing the rockets that will take us back to the moon and beyond. In fact, the first test of one of the new rockets is set for just 30 months from now. In a Weather Brains Extra, Reaching for the Stars, we meet Steve Cook, who's overseeing NASA's new rocket development program. Steve works at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. Now, one thing's for sure, Steve has a very interesting job helping plan how we'll travel through deep space. We'll talk about that, as well as his concerns about America's long-term ability to be a leader in space exploration and technology in general. You're overseeing development of the next generation of launch vehicles that we'll be using in America's space program. How many more shuttle launches are planned, and then how do we travel into space after that?
We've got 14 more shuttle launches that are planned, and between now and 2010. The plan is, after the shuttle retires in 2010, that we will use the Ares 1 and the Ares 5, which are the new series of launch vehicles we're developing, which use some of the shuttle hardware that we fly today. And it will carry a new, what we call, crew exploration vehicle, which is named Orion, up to low Earth orbit and then on to the moon.
Okay, so since we're going back to rockets, I'm assuming then you must see a real value in using rockets as your launch vehicles to get the heavy kind of payloads into space that you're going to be dealing with.
Absolutely. In fact, what we're talking about is what we call an inline rocket, where we've got the crew on top instead of on the side like we do on the space shuttle today. So the crew is out of harm's way from debris coming down off of the tank or other areas. They're on top. The heat shield is actually protected behind them. And then we have what we call a launch abort system, which is a small rocket motor tower up on top that anywhere from sitting on the pad all the way to the cutoff of the main engines and putting the Orion in orbit, we can pull the crew off safely all the way through the ascent phase, which we cannot do on shuttle today. So in a sense, it's taking some of the best of shuttle from a propulsion standpoint, as well as the architectural simplicity of Apollo, and putting the two together to give us a very heavy lift capability that we'll eventually need to go onto the moon and then onto Mars.
Speaking of moon and Mars, what are the timetables? You've got a lot of testing, I know, and more research to be done. What are all the timetables involved in making this happen?
On the Ares 1, we will have a first test flight in 30 months in April of 2009. That'll be a real first stage with a mass simulator, or what we call a dummy upper stage on top. And that will simulate the first stage flight, because the first stage uses a derivative of the current shuttle solid rocket boosters, the twin white boosters next to the orange tank when the shuttle flies today. It'll use a single one of those with a liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen upper stage above it. So we'll have that in test in 2009. We'll also test our new 5-segment solid rocket motor system in 2009, and we'll be into testing on our J2X engine in 2009. So we've got a lot of things we'll be doing testing up to that point, but that's a really big year for us along the way. We will be far into our design at that point. Then we'll begin a series of flight tests that will go to orbit starting in 2012, and then we'll have the first human-capable Orion after we've done a series of unmanned flight tests by 2014 that will take us the Ares 1. Now, starting in 2011, we're going to start the development of the Ares 5, so there'll be some overlap in the development of those two systems. And the Ares 5 will be flying by 2018, and it'll have the capability to take about 6 times the payload that Ares 1 does to low Earth orbit. And it will take up the lander, it'll take up the stage, it'll take the Orion and the lander itself all the way to the moon and back. In fact, it can throw about 40% more payload to the moon than the Saturn V Apollo system does. So with all that extra payload and capacity, we intend to land on the moon no later than 2020 and start being able to build up outposts on the moon over time, and which we may start at the South Pole, for example, and build from there.
So by the year 2020, then, we are going to be much more seriously exploring deep space.
Yeah, we will have restarted our exploration beyond low Earth orbit at that point. That's correct. And then we'll start from that. That will allow us to build up the capability to stay for long periods of time on the moon, do the exploration there, build up our capability, test out the technologies for long-term stay. And if you have a problem, you're only 2 days away from home. And then the next step beyond that is to go on to Mars. But actually, a lot of the systems we're building to go to the moon, you also need to go to Mars. You need the Ares 1, you need the Ares 5, you need the Orion crew exploration vehicle. You're going to need a lot of the crew systems that you have to have on board, habitation systems. You'll develop a lot of those to go to the moon, and then there'll be less things you have to do now when you get ready to go on to Mars.
It's really a kind of a
building block approach, one step at a time, as we expand out the human presence throughout the solar system.
When I think about going to Mars, it seems to me like you've really got some challenges there to plan things like crew, food, sustenance, not to mention fuel.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about, depending on the mission, it can range from up to 3 years that you would be gone away from home, depending on the flight profile that you look at. So when you factor all that in, you've got to deal with, one of the things we want to look at is, how can we utilize the resources of the site that we go to? You know, if you think about it, when the first explorers came over to this country, they didn't bring everything with them. Some of the early missions they brought, or early voyages over, they brought more just to be able to live, but eventually they had to start living off the land. And we need to have the capability to do that. So that's one of the things we'll actually test out on the moon, is our ability to do that, even though the resources are different from those that are on Mars. But when we get to Mars, how can we use the resources that are there to build up our capability so we don't have to haul everything there and then bring what we need later on home? And then the propulsion system to get you to Mars, it could be a derivative of the system that will inject you to the moon, or it could be a nuclear-based system that starts in low Earth orbit and then moves beyond. And so those are all the kind of things that we'll be looking at as we move ahead.
And you're doing all this research from right here in Alabama.
We are. On the launch vehicles, we have the responsibility right here in North Alabama for the rockets. I mean, this is really a return to the roots of why Huntsville is called the Rocket City. Huntsville was responsible, of course, for building the Saturn series in the 60s and building the shuttle propulsion systems. And now we're taking that legacy one step further, and we're returning back to our roots of developing these technologies and these systems right here in Huntsville.
You've had some concerns about the number of young people getting into science, making science their career. What are those thoughts you have?
Well, if you look at some projections, would tell us that by the year 2010, up to 90% of the engineers on the globe could reside in Asia. If you look at the number of students today that are pursuing advanced degrees in the science and the mathematics and the engineering, they are down dramatically. When you look today, that a lot of our graduate schools are filled with foreign national students because they find a good education here and they come over, but the schools can't find enough own homegrown Americans to go to school there. They're attracting more and more foreign nationals. And so those foreign nationals, some will stay here, of course, contribute to the economy. Many, many will go back home. And what if you look over history, the great nations have always been those that have maintained their technological capability and have always been the technological leaders in terms of everything that we do. And if we lose that capability, if we lose that edge, you know, it really is kind of scary for the long term, what it means for this country in the long term. And so we hope that by going forward with bold exploration missions like this, we can attract young people into the science, technology, engineering, mathematics types of fields. It doesn't have to be working on the rocket, but maybe the rocket and the Orion and the landers will inspire young folks to take up the cause, much as what happened in the 1960s. We had a huge number of students that moved into those fields and really propelled us into the 70s and 80s and 90s. and even to today. But looking down the stream, if we're not kicking out enough of these engineers and scientists and mathematicians in those kind of fields, it really, I think, portends for us from a security perspective in the long term. Because history will tell you, again, that the countries that are the explorers, the countries that lead the technological side of things, will be the world leaders. And we are where we are in large part because of our technological prowess. We need to maintain it and continue to be at the forefront of that.
America was so dominant in Apollo, Mercury, Gemini. What I'm hearing out of you is that American dominance may be coming to an end.
Well, in the space era, if you go back, it was really a space race between two countries, between the U.S. and Russia, and in fact, the Russia started out ahead, and we ended up winning because we got to the moon sooner. But space is no longer limited. Space access is no longer limited to those two countries. Today, the U.S., Russia, and now China can launch humans successfully into flight. But there are other countries all over the globe that can also launch unmanned payloads, the Europeans, the Indians, the Japanese. It is becoming a growing number of players, and we need to stay at the forefront of that field. May I encourage everybody else to get into this game, but we need to stay at the top of our game with more people coming into it if we're going to stay the leaders and over the long term. And again, leaders have always been at the forefront technologically, and we believe that this new exploration vision that we've got will help to propel us into that future.
Your background is heavily rooted in scientific academia, University of Minnesota and others. What do we as a society need to do to make science more attractive to young people to make a career choice?
Well, I think one of the things we need to do is show young people that there are exciting careers that are out there in the science and mathematics. I mean, it was always my dream to go work and build a rocket. I mean, and now I'm getting to live that dream out right now. I couldn't imagine any better job based on the goals I set out for myself as a young child. And so my encouragement would be, set your sights high. You can achieve it. There are things that are exciting out there, whether you're building a rocket, whether you're on the cutting edge of electronics technology, biomedical technology. There are so many things out there that enable us to take the next step. And I think we need to help educate young people that all these great technologies with cell phones and the medical technology we have, that's there because people pursued careers in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And without them, we don't have that capability. And we need to continue to show young people where their future careers can be. And one of the things NASA has done is NASA has sponsored what it calls NASA Explorer Schools. And these go into underserved areas all over the country, rural areas, inner cities, et cetera, and there are some right here in Alabama, to be able to bring the NASA message home and bring it into the school and make it a part of the curriculum for those students early on. And we need to encourage those kinds of things as we go forward. And frankly, I think we just need to encourage our young people to take on tough things. And that to not take easy routes, but to take the harder challenges, because through harder challenges, there are more rewards. And I think that's part of the message we need to put out.
Some of NASA's leaders tomorrow are probably in the fourth and fifth grade right now, as you and I are talking, so that gets into what you would probably tell them.
They absolutely are. They absolutely are.
So you really probably do have a bumper sticker in your car that says, as a matter of fact, I am a rocket scientist.
No, I don't. I have the Saturn, for those in Alabama, I do have the Saturn V car tag on the back of my car. And one of my partners here in this endeavor who works with us, his license plate says On to Mars. So that's a big part of our lives around here.
You have a fascinating job. I bet you like it a lot.
I love it. Absolutely. And we have a fantastic team. Let me tell you, we have a fantastic team here at the Marshall Space Flight Center. All of our contractor partners here and all around the country. And it really, the team is what makes it exciting. It makes it, the vision is what makes it exciting. The team is what makes it wonderful to come in every day.
From a political perspective, do you have concerns about continuity of funding, things like that, to make your long-term plans work?
Oh, that's obviously a very big concern. And one of the key goals here is to make this vision sustainable over the long haul. So part of the reason we want to educate folks on what we're doing is so they see the importance of it, and so it can survive multiple congresses, multiple administrations as we go forward. And frankly, we need to show progress. We need to show our investors, who are the American taxpayers, that we are wisely using their money and we're making great success as we go forward. They need to understand we're going to have some problems along the way, and we're going to that's just a part of exploring on the edge, and to work with us and stay with us through those as we build these new rocket engines and try to test them. And they don't work, we fix them and we move on. That's just a part of being on the cutting edge, and that's the kind of things I think we need to. I believe that again, as shareholders, as investors in our endeavor, i.e., the vision for space exploration, we owe it to the American people to continually tell them where we're making progress and how we're moving forward on this activity.
NASA's not a big chunk of the federal budget.
NASA is about 0.7% of the federal budget. So it's a very small, for every dollar we pay in, less than 0.7 of a penny funds what we're doing. And it still adds up to a lot of money. And we're still talking billions of dollars of investment here. But relative to the overall budget, I think that's, again, it's a relatively small piece of the federal budget to help maintain the nation's technical prowess and to do what great nations do.
So the next time you step outside to enjoy one of those clear, crisp autumn nights Alabama can be so famous for, take a look up at the stars and know that people right here in our state are getting us closer to them than ever before. Don't know if you guys saw this in the Birmingham News Sunday, October 22nd edition, an op-ed piece by a gentleman named Jim McDade. Talk about interesting timing. He wrote a piece about where NASA is going about this same rocket program, and he makes a very good point I wanted to highlight, and that is he talks about the fact that NASA is a very open agency, and that makes it vulnerable to people wanting to pick at the dollars spent. But what if we knew how many of our dollars are spent by all those other government agencies that work in the dark? The agencies that you ask about spending money and they say, well, we can't tell you. That's classified. Interesting to think about anyway. Thanks to Steve Cook with NASA for talking with us too. Guys, just think about this. May not be long in our lifetimes anyway. Hopefully that we'll be doing some very serious deep space exploration. I think that is absolutely amazing.
I love that automobile tag, on to Mars.
You got that right. And they're serious.
I hope a lot of people listening to this out of state heard that this guy's at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. So
yeah.
we do have running water and electricity and indoor toilets here, and we're a big part of the space program.
The state that's typically last or next to last in everything is, oh, yeah, by the way, they're helping design rockets that'll carry us to Mars.
There you go.
And we wear shoes.
James, you're not going to try to strap Brian to one of those Mars-bound missions, are you? Is everything cool with you guys now?
Sure, no problem. I'll keep him here.
You got to hang on to him for the storm stuff anyway.
Yeah, so. I'm about to say, we need him for the severe weather, so we'll strap somebody else on there.
What severe weather? We've had no hurricanes. We've had no severe weather. I think we're going to end the year with nothing.
Works for me.
Maybe easier work for you guys.
I think I'm going to sit back and open the window and breathe some of this cool, fresh air.
JB still got his mind up in the stars.
Yes.
I think JB's asleep out there.
No, I'm going to take a power nap in a few minutes, but I'm wide awake.
Okay.
I thought that was a very interesting interview. Very much so.
Very well, gentlemen. A reminder that the opinions expressed here on Weather Brains are strictly those of the speaker, not necessarily those of ABC 3340. If you'd like to contact us, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. If you'd like to leave a voicemail for us, you can do that too. Our number is 206-339-5482. 206-339-5482. For James Spann, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters, I'm David Black. Thanking you for listening, we hope you can join us again next time for the next edition of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006. All rights are reserved. Adios. Gentlemen, thank you all. That was fun.
Very nice show. Thanks, sir. See you, boys.
Y'all be good.
Bye. Good job, David.
Thanks.